In the flickering glow of the campfire, a group of hunter-gatherers huddle beneath a canopy of stars. The air is crisp, their breaths visible in the cool night air. At the center of the gathering stands a formidable figure, a male whose muscles, hardened by years of survival, ripple beneath scarred skin. He is the leader. An alpha male who has won his place through strength, dominance, and control. For over 10 million years, figures like him have defined power among our ancient ancestors. But he is not the only male present. Around the campfire are seated males of a lower status, perhaps a little older or a little younger, or simply less strong, less tough. Until now, he has ruled over them unchallenged by might, threatened them into submission, beaten them whenever challenged. He's kept the females close by offering protection, and threatened any that have been tempted by another male. But nothing lasts forever. For from his lofty position, he has not noticed how, these last few weeks, the other males have been communicating, collaborating. In secret, they have been sharing their discontent, sharing their ideas for change. And so, tonight, for the first time, this alpha male will face something he cannot counter with brute strength. His rule will be cut short by something far more subtle. A collective decision. The tribe is no longer reassured by strength, but seeking something else in their leader. The world is changing, the climate is unpredictable, other groups are encroaching on their land. These new challenges need new approaches. They need compromise and diplomacy. He could fight, but even an alpha can't take on the whole group. His fall has been long planned, he has no allies. As the first stone strikes, followed by another, he stumbles. Another from another hand and another. The females join in, a great noise rises, and the alpha knows it is time to leave or die. The rules of survival have changed. The era of dominance by sheer force is over. And this truly is the beginning of a profound transformation, a new way of life, one where decisions were made through cooperation and shared understanding. It marked the dawn of a more egalitarian society, where strength was no longer the defining measure of a leader, but instead the ability to bring benefit to the group. A time when leadership was impermanent, the mantle of responsibility passing to whoever had the skills to lead the group through a particular challenge, hunters or foragers or fighters. This is the story of how the alpha male fell and a new chapter in human history began, where the power of the many outweighed the power of the one. But it is also the story of his return. Near a quiet stretch of grassland in what is now Eastern Europe, Apache Crocuta, a much larger, stronger ancestor of modern hyenas, is stalking towards moonlit rocks. Its sharp eyes catch the sight of something lying motionless up ahead, the remains of another creature left by another predator. It lets out a whoop that rises into the air. The rest of the pack begin to assemble. The Apache Crocuta approaches the body cautiously, its thick neck muscles tense as it sniffs the air. There is no immediate threat here, no rival predator to claim the carcass, so it moves closer, drawn by the promise of an easy meal. The other members of the pack watch on. The dead thing is a bison, or what remains of it. A younger Apache Crocuta jumps in, approaching the remnants of flesh clinging to the bones. But the lead Apache Crocuta is quick to respond, leaping at the younger pack member, snarling, lunging with all its teeth. The subordinate backs away. The leader turns to the carcass and, as is its right, starts alone to work at the meat, biting through the ribcage, scattering remnants of the body in its wake. Only once they have had their fill
will the rest eat?
Dominance and hierarchy don't fossilize, so piecing together the leadership systems of ancient creatures is a task more challenging than most. Scenes such as this would have unfolded if Pachycrocuta lived in societies similar to the modern-day spotted and brown hyenas, which recent studies have suggested are its closest living relatives. But that is just one example, for when we look at the wider animal kingdom, past and present, leadership can look very different to that of humans. In migratory birds, such as geese, who first took the air around 10 to 12 million years ago, one bird will often take the lead on the long flights across the globe. Leadership will rotate as the leading bird tires, and this role is often taken on by older birds with more stamina. Indeed, it's not always a male who leads groups in the animal kingdom. The sea's most powerful predators, orcas, are led by matriarchs, often the oldest and most experienced female in the pod. Females that have passed reproductive age are found to be more likely to lead a pod than younger orcas, possibly because of their experience, leading to a coalition around a strong female. Nor is it always the strongest or the most aggressive who takes charge. In many species, in fact, it's those with the greatest need, such as hunger or survival, that step into leadership roles. The three-spined stickleback is a fairly modern species by fish standards, having emerged in the seas sometime around 13 million years ago. Yet we see a kind of leadership among these fish. Studies have shown that in groups of sticklebacks, individuals who are more food-deprived tend to take the lead in guiding the shoal towards food sources. This behavior is driven by the greater motivation of the hungrier fish, causing them to swim at the front and influence the direction of the group. The hungriest sticklebacks lead the shoal because their need for food motivates them to explore more actively. The shoal benefits as a whole by following the leader, who is more motivated to find food due to its hunger. But what about our own lineage? What is human leadership, and how has it changed over time? One of the best ways we can look to understand the very earliest origins of leadership in humanity is to look to our closest living evolutionary cousins, the great apes. What hints can we glean about leadership structures of our ancient ancestors from them? In a remote forest, a chimpanzee is born, destined to leave a lasting mark on his community. He is large, larger and more aggressive than most chimps of his age, and as he grows, he learns to use his strength. He's a good hunter, making successful kills and guarding what he has brought back to the community. But just as importantly, he is also adept at getting what he wants through intimidation and violence, forcing his fellow chimps to share their own kills so that he continues to eat well. No one wants to take on a chimp of this size, with such a powerful ability to hurt or subdue. Opportunity strikes when the group's leader falls ill. A fight ensues and he easily overcomes the ailing former leader, becoming the new alpha male. He forms alliances with other males and guards the female chimps, ensuring he secures his genetic legacy. He deals harshly with anyone who steps over his lines. As alpha, he rules with a firm hand. He uses his size and aggression to ensure he receives adequate respect and submission from others. He rules his community for 5 successful years, a fairly long time by chimpanzee standards, where an alpha male must always be careful to watch for pretenders to their throne. In a world where brute strength is the key to success, even an alpha as strong as this one is only safe as long as he is able to fight. One of the best ways we can look to understand the very earliest origins of leadership in humanity is to look at our closest living evolutionary cousins, the great apes. How does leadership among the other great apes show similarities to humans, and where does it diverge? Chimpanzees, gorillas, and bonobos offer a glimpse into the diversity of leadership across our closest living relatives, each species exhibiting a slightly different approach to power, authority, and social organization. These primate hierarchies not only help us understand their behavior, but may also shed light on the evolution of human leadership as well. Chimpanzees, known for their complex social structures, have strict dominance hierarchies, with a single alpha male at the top and an alpha female below him. Alpha status is usually inherited, but in some cases requires brute strength or intelligence. After rising to this position, in order to maintain dominance, an alpha male will often display aggression, breaking up conflicts and asserting authority over rivals. However, even the most powerful alpha male is not invincible. Coalitions of lower-ranking males can challenge and overthrow a leader, highlighting the ever-precarious nature of chimpanzee politics. And this is why, despite their reputation for violence, there was a little more nuance to the chimpanzee alpha male or alpha female. Yes, they must be physically strong and have a tendency towards aggression, but they must also schmooze their clanmates. Alphas form bonds with males and females through social grooming, a key currency in chimp society. Indeed, in reality, it's a mix of aggression and social interaction that truly secures a chimp's place at the top. In fact, studies have shown that after a fight, male chimps will often groom each other as a show of reconciliation. The more two male chimps groom each other day to day, the more likely they are to come together again after a tussle. Gorillas are also ruled by an alpha male. Usually the biggest and strongest of the males in a group, he is the decision maker. He leads the group, protects it, and is rewarded with priority access to resources and mates. Mature males develop a distinctive patch of silver hair as they age, usually around 12 years old, and are known as silverbacks. While several silverbacks may exist within a troop, only one holds the top spot as alpha, commanding authority over the group. Occasionally, a younger silverback will challenge the leader, but failure means exile. Often young males who have become silverbacks but are not strong enough to compete for alpha male status will leave and roam the jungle alone until they are strong enough to attract females and start their own troop. The strength required means this often won't happen until these males are around 15 years of age. And so many simply need to bide their time, like Titus did. Born in the lush Virunga Mountains of Rwanda, he was observed by famous primatologist Diane Fossey. His troop was targeted by poachers who killed their leader, Titus's father. The females soon left, looking for a mature silverback, and so Titus lived among the other young males, including Beatsme, a bigger, stronger male. After many years roaming the jungle as single males, the bachelors were joined by a small group of females. Beatsme took his chance, chasing away all the other males, except Titus, and taking on the role of leader. Titus would remain in Beatsme's shadow for 8 years, until finally feeling strong enough, he fought him into submission, thus becoming leader of his own troop, and ended up leading the largest known troop in the world. But unlike chimps and gorillas, our other close relatives, the bonobos, approach things a little differently. Bonobo societies are more egalitarian and matriarchal than the other apes. Indeed, female bonobos hold significant sway, male bonobos often relying on the status of their mothers to rise within the social ranks, aggression playing a far smaller role in maintaining power. Instead, bonobos build coalitions through social bonding, sex, and cooperation, making their leadership structure less hierarchical and more fluid than their primate cousins. Indeed, this even applies between separate social groups. A bonobo community in the Kokolopuri was observed for 2 years, and during that time they would encounter neighboring bonobo groups, but their interactions were often social, not aggressive. They would groom, share food, and happily maintain their borders. These contrasting styles of leadership among the great apes suggests that the evolution of leadership in humans may have been anything but straightforward. The different strategies employed by these primates, from the aggression of gorillas to the cooperative dynamics of bonobos, reflect a broader evolutionary trend in which the traits that make for effective leadership vary dramatically depending on the social environment. We share ancestry with all of these apes, and we can perhaps see certain traits within their leadership styles that are familiar and some that are less so. And so could this ever-present system of hierarchy mean that there is a genetic element to leadership? Has evolution bred into the DNA of some of us the natural ability to lead. While there is no definitive leadership gene, scientific research suggests that certain genetic markers may be linked to traits commonly found in leaders. One genetic marker often associated with leadership traits is RS4950, which has been linked to personality characteristics such as extroversion and assertiveness. These traits are critical in leadership, but the gene itself doesn't guarantee the holder will take on such a role. It can only predispose certain individuals to develop leadership behaviors in the right environments. Then there is 5-HTTLPR, known as the serotonin transporter gene. This gene may play a role in how individuals biologically react to prolonged stress. Modern and ancient leaders alike were frequently placed in high-stress situations requiring emotional resilience. Variants of this gene may be linked to a lower chance of anxiety and depression in the face of stressful periods, qualities crucial for successful leadership. But, as with most facts about genes, these genetic markers can only contribute to certain leadership traits. Who is suited to leadership and who becomes a leader is shaped not only by genes, but by childhood influences, environmental factors, and as much today as ever, by the contexts in which a person lives. And so what was it that changed for our ancestors that took us from leadership structures similar to apes to something far more subtle? It is 655 AD in the Imperial Palace in Chang'an, known today as Xi'an, China. Wu Zetian is a concubine who has caught the attention of the newly crowned Emperor Gaozong. But Wu has no intention of remaining a mere concubine, supporting her emperor and giving him children. She has grander ambitions. Her first goal is to ensure she, and she alone, is the center of the emperor's affection and political power. She targets the Empress Wang and the emperor's favorite concubine, Consort Xiao. Nobody knows exactly what happened to Wu's newborn daughter, and some would always believe her fate came at her mother's hands, but when the infant is discovered dead, Wu is quick to point the finger at the Empress and consort. Grief-stricken father Emperor Gaozong is easily convinced of the guilt of both Empress Wang and Consort Xiao. They are stripped of their titles, imprisoned, and eventually executed. With her rivals eliminated, Wu is elevated to Empress Consort, but this is just the start of her rise. She would go on to increase her influence over the Emperor, convincing him to depose any who defy her, even going so far as to force her own sons into exile or abdication, so that in 690 AD, she finally took her place as the first and only female emperor of China. Wu was ruthless, using her wits to manipulate those around her and consolidate her position in power. But these were obviously not the actions of an archetypal alpha male, but something more subtle, more knowing. And so how did we go from the alpha male to leaders who no longer subdue their followers with aggression and displays of strength, but secured their position through intrigue, plots, and the art of cunning? The challenge is that when turning our attention from our great ape cousins to our own ancestry, the further back in time we search, the harder it becomes to draw conclusions about how communities lived. There are fewer bones, and even fewer artifacts. And so what can we glean from the meager evidence we have? Who were our leaders before we were fully human? There was a long period of history that leaves us little evidence from which to draw conclusions about the way we lived, a time when multiple species of hominins climbed trees and walked upright. We can deduce brain size and see sexual dimorphism, which are useful and make some assumptions about the way they traverse the land, but not much more than that. Still, it can help us at least get some sense of what leadership might have entailed for these long-lost creatures. Evidence suggests that some species, like Ororin tugenensis, who roamed some 6 million years ago in the Tugen Hills of Kenya, and Ardipithecus ramidus, who lived 4.5 million years ago, walked upright perhaps some of the time, but were still very adept at climbing trees. Others, like Sahelanthropus tridensis, dated to 7 million years ago, were much more comparable to chimpanzees, with similar brain sizes and slimmer evidence of bipedalism. Indeed, for Sahelanthropus tridensis, what we know is mostly taken from just a single cranium and a few other fragmentary remains. What can this scant evidence tell us? Well, the lack of extreme sexual dimorphism, difference between male and females, could mean that Sahelanthropus may not have been as male-dominated or aggressive as some primate societies. A similar story is told in Aurorin tugenensis bones. Again, the limited fossils we have of Aurorin potentially suggest less sexual dimorphism, which might mean a less competitive social environment, where males didn't fight for dominance over females or resources as fiercely as chimps or gorillas. But ultimately, there is little we can say for sure. Ardipithecus ramidus also follows this pattern, living 4 million years ago. The reduced size of the canine teeth in both males and females compared to their ape relatives, suggesting less male-to-male aggression compared to modern great apes. And so perhaps, here in these ancient species, there is a hint of what is to come. A less aggressive, less brutal kind of male could be emerging. Perhaps a new form of leadership, something more sophisticated, involving cooperation, communication, and practical skills. Could this have been the beginning of the end of the alpha male? Neanderthals had long been considered brutal, simpler versions of ourselves, but more recent research has uncovered evidence that perhaps they lived a more sophisticated life than we once thought. And we can find some clues as to how those close cousins might have lived in the remains scattered across their roaming grounds of Europe and Asia. Take the 30 Neanderthal individuals found at the Chagraskaya and Okhladnikov caves in southern Siberia. By looking into their DNA, we can understand something about their lives. This DNA showed strong familial connections, including a father-daughter pair buried together, as well as second-degree relatives, indicating that this group of Neanderthals lived in small, interconnected, familial communities. This has been further supported by analyzing patterns of genetic diversity, which has shown high levels of similarity in the DNA between individuals. Some Neanderthals, then, likely lived in tight-knit family groups, rarely mixing with outsiders except when it came to mating. In these Neanderthals, the Y chromosomal data, found only in males, showed less diversity than the mitochondrial DNA, found only in females. This means that it may well have been the case that females in this region migrated between groups while males stayed in their birth communities, a pattern indicative of patrilocal social structures, a social system where, after partnering, a couple lives with or near the male partner's community. This means males tend to stay within their birth group while females leave, or perhaps are taken from, their original communities. Living in these close, related communities means that these Siberian Neanderthals were likely well-suited to cooperative behaviors such as group hunting, caring for the sick, and sharing food. And we have evidence from other archaeological sites that Neanderthals did indeed take good care of the elderly and infirm, despite the likelihood those individuals would have slowed down movement and required resources. A key example of this being one of the Neanderthal skeletons from Shanidar Cave in Iraq, which was found to show signs of severe disabilities, including a withered arm, blindness in one eye, and other injuries, suggesting this individual lived for years with the help and support of others in their community. A Neanderthal buried at Chapelle-aux-Saints in France, known as the Old Man of La Chapelle, was found in a deliberately dug pit, indicating intentional placement. The area around the skeleton also contains stone tools and animal bones, which some researchers interpret as potential grave goods, indicating ritualistic behavior or symbolic thinking. This man was very old when he was buried, and was perhaps revered, hence the arrangements of items in his grave. And importantly, they also appear to have had the ability to create and use tools, more specifically, Levallois tools. These are tools made using a specific technique that requires striking flint in a particular way as to knock off shards, creating a sharp edge. That these communities were able to carry out such a skill implies the ability to teach and learn, or more broadly, engage in knowledge transfer within groups, which would have fostered the development of shared cultural practices. and so we can only wonder what else might they have shared with each other. With no written records, it's impossible to say for certain, but these burial sites certainly suggest that Neanderthals were capable of complex behaviours, empathy, and perhaps even early forms of ritual. Such social abilities could well have facilitated a social hierarchy to emerge in some form. Our other close, though long extinct relatives, Homo heidelbergensis, are considered a common ancestor between Homo sapiens and Neanderthals. They were, despite their earlier existence between 300,000 and 700,000 years ago, still most likely highly socially developed. And we also know that they were a species well adapted to dealing with changing environments. Homo heidelbergensis lived during periods of dramatic climate changes, leading to shifts in their habitats that must have forced them to adapt. The use of sophisticated hunting tools, such as wooden spears found at the Schöningen site in Germany, demonstrates that Homo heidelbergensis probably engaged in complex group hunting strategies, which would have required a good level of communication among group members. And the presence of modern, human-like hyoid bones, used to support the tongue at Homo heidelbergensis archaeological sites, suggests the possible capability of language. Although we cannot say if Homo heidelbergensis did indeed talk with each other in a true sense, as other physical features involved in language production and comprehension rarely fossilize. And they also achieved an important step for any hominin. It is believed they found the ability to control fire, direct evidence being found from around 780,000 years ago. Scorched tools and burnt wood are all the remains of what might have been warm fires around which these ancient hominins gathered to talk, plan, and listen. And finally, the earliest fossil evidence for our even earlier ancestors, Homo erectus, appears around 1.9 million years ago in Africa. Homo erectus quickly spread into Asia and possibly Europe, and evidence from sites like Dmanisi in the Republic of Georgia and Jokodian in China suggests that they might have lived in small bands that cooperated for survival. Indeed, fossilized remains of individuals in close proximity and evidence of shared living spaces indicate a form of social bonding, possibly between kin. Tools found at Homo erectus sites, such as hand axes, suggest that knowledge and skills were shared within groups, pointing to some level of communication and cultural transmission. And the care of individuals, as seen in a toothless skull from Dmanisi, indicates that older or infirm members may have been looked after by others, which suggests a level of empathy and cooperation. Although much remains speculative, the fossil record paints a picture of Homo erectus as a species that may have lived in cohesive communities that laid the groundwork for more complex social behaviours. Of course, we cannot know for certain if this means that any of these early hominin groups had leaders in a sense that we would recognise. But what can we suppose about the form early leadership might have taken? Were they diplomatic elites? Or were they brutish alpha males dominating through strength? The answer, quite possibly, is neither. Let's return to the present day for a moment and visit the Hadza people of Tanzania, one of the last true hunter-gatherer societies on Earth. Even today, as they walk in the footsteps of their ancestors, they reveal the dynamic and situational nature of leadership that has guided human societies for millennia. There are no chiefs, no permanent rulers, just individuals who rise to the occasion. That is, for any given situation, hunting, building work, moving to a new location, those with those skills take charge for a time. When a hunting expedition is underway, the most skilled hunter might lead, guiding others through the tangled underbrush in pursuit of prey. But when this task is done, his authority vanishes, someone else takes over, and he becomes a follower. Thus, in this way, leadership ebbs and flows, changing with need and situation. This is a common mode of leadership among hunter-gatherers. If we travel now to the vast, arid expanses of southern Africa, we can find the San people. For the San, leadership is about listening, observing, and understanding. When decisions must be made, the San gather around their evening fires, They argue and listen until finally a consensus emerges. The appointed leader for the moment, a skilled tracker for example, or an elder with hard-won wisdom, holds no permanent power. Instead, their influence is fleeting. This is the essence of situational egalitarianism, where leadership is as fluid and adaptable as the shifting sands. And while the Hadza and San people are, of course, far more advanced in the way they live and survive than our distant past ancestors, they may give us some clues as to how a nomadic, hunter-gatherer society might have organized many hundreds of thousands of years ago. We can see that these communities engage in skill-based leadership. This is not necessarily a choice of egalitarianism, but may be a matter of necessity. Imagine for a moment that the chances of eating well or starving rely on the success of a hunt, or where a wrong turn when navigating could lead to death. This is unlike settled communities with their built-up resources and their reliable flow of food and water. In these high-stakes situations, only those with the sharpest eyes, the quickest reflexes, and the deepest knowledge of the land should lead. And so these modern examples hint that it is unlikely that nomadic, hunter-gatherer societies, even those very far back in time, were governed by rigid hierarchies. No anointed leader or alpha males here. Instead, they too likely embraced situational leadership, a system where authority shifts from one person to another based on the task at hand. And when it came to decision-making, perhaps about where to move next or how to deal with a community member who had broken the rules, consensus-based decision-making may have been the norm. Indeed, in today's small, tight-knit communities of hunter-gatherers, every voice has some degree of influence, with communal discussion held and communal decisions made. And so clearly, at some point in evolutionary history, there came a moment when the alpha male of our distant ancestors and close ape cousins was deposed for good. But why would this have happened? What environmental pressures would have pushed us away from a system that had worked so well for our ape cousins? The evolution of the human brain, and, just as crucially, language, may have something to do with it. As humans developed more sophisticated cognitive abilities, leaders were no longer just the strongest or more dominant individuals, they were also strategists and negotiators. The social brain hypothesis suggests that the expansion of the human brain was driven by the need to navigate increasingly complex social networks. This idea suggests that, in general, species with a larger brain relative to body size tend to have greater social complexity, and that it is the latter that has prompted the former. This is borne out when we look at animal behavior. Animals that pair bond have larger brain sizes for their bodies, for example. Primates, including us humans, have very big, complex brains, with a particularly developed neocortex, a region of the brain concerned with reasoning, emotion, thought, memory, consciousness, and language. We Homo sapiens may have developed language as early as 200,000 years ago. We can't know for sure, but this time period lines up with fossil evidence that shows anatomy suited to speech, and genes linked to muscular structures of the face and jaw that would facilitate language. Indeed, human language is absolutely unique in the animal kingdom. While other species certainly have forms of language, it is limited in its capacity to communicate complex ideas. Even apes taught to sign by humans express only simple concepts, such as wanting to eat or wanting to drink. But human language is almost endless in its ability to allow communication of desires, needs, thoughts, ideas, fears, and anxieties. And so language may have allowed early humans to persuade and to organize group activities. Our ability to speak would have also given us a greater ability to communicate with nearby tribes, and to share knowledge more easily within and between communities. But perhaps most importantly, language leveled the playing field. Language would have allowed subordinates to talk, share experiences, group together, and perhaps speak out. This cognitive and linguistic evolution may have laid the groundwork for more advanced forms of leadership, where leaders could unite their communities through shared narratives and collective goals, but also ensured that leaders had to listen to resistance or criticism. The demise of the alpha male may have arisen from the newfound need for compromise and group discussion. Blunt aggression in the face of rational debate would no longer work. As humans continued to evolve, so too their social structures and leadership changed to fit these new dynamics. The era of the alpha male in its rawest form was over. No more chest beating or fighting to the death. Our leaders needed to rely less on aggression and dominance over others and find different paths to power. And while aggression and dominance are still relevant in some contexts, human leadership has, over time, become more about strategy, cooperation, and the art of building consensus. But as time passed and needs changed, so too did the nature of leadership. Smoke curls into the air from a dying fire. A family group are busy tying up animal skins, collecting together tools. Children help carry bone needles, flint knives. The adults are discussing the best route to take to pastures new. And as the day dawns, the tribe sets out, a thin line of figures on an open plain. They need to find new prey, new sites for foraging. They are nomads, and their life relies on being on the move. Before we settled into farming communities, Homo sapiens lived as hunter-gatherers. We were mostly nomadic, moving frequently in search of food, although some communities may have settled for short periods due to weather changes. In contrast to Neolithic graves, the grave goods for these ancient peoples show little variation in quality or quantity, implying that earlier Homo sapiens had limited social stratification. Archaeologists have concluded that there appears to be little evidence of wealth disparity. But spiritual and ritual leadership, however, may have played a role in the life of these humans. Artifacts such as cave paintings and figurines suggest the existence of spiritual practices, possibly led by shamans or other figures with ritual authority. Take the burial site listed at Dolní Vesternice, located in what is now the Czech Republic. The site dates back around 27,000 years.
Unearthed from the deep, the bones of a woman, around 40 years old at the time of her death.
Her body was laid to rest between two great mammoth shoulder blades, and scattered around her remain more treasures. Arctic fox bones and red ochre, a pigment commonly associated with ritual burials. And, nestled in among the other items, is a carved ivory figure depicting a female face with an anomaly that matched the woman's own facial asymmetry. The figurine may be a portrait of the buried woman, making it one of the oldest known examples of portraiture. The presence of these artifacts, along with the ceremonial nature of the burial, suggests she held a position of spiritual significance within her community, possibly as a shaman. Indeed, other signs of ritual have been found at burial sites in Wales, dating to 33,000 years ago, and Portugal from around 24,000 years ago. By this time, we were clearly anointing some individuals with special status. But it remains a mystery just how impactful on decision-making these figures would have been, or how long-lasting their influence.
But things were soon to change, and in a sense, the Alpha was about to make his return.
It is thousands of years ago in the fertile lands of Sumer, present-day southern Iraq. Here lives a young shepherd named Dumuzid. He tends his flocks dutifully, wandering the fields each day. But destiny has greater plans for him. Dumuzid's journey begins in the city of Bad Tibira, a place where life was dictated by the gods, who could be merciful and merciless in equal measure. And so one fateful day, as Dumuzid rests under a tree, the heavens speak. "You shall be king," says the voice of the great god Enki. "Your name will be sung in the halls for eternity." And with that, the young shepherd becomes the shepherd king, chosen by the gods to lead his people. Under Dumuzid's rule, the region of Bad Tabira flourishes. The fields yield good harvests, rivers run full, and the flocks multiply. The people sing his praises, for Dumuzid brings life and prosperity to all he touches. And even as a king, he remains humble, never forgetting his roots in the fields and the rhythms of the seasons, walking among nature. Today, Dumuzid's name appears on a small clay tablet, just 20 centimeters in height, first discovered in 1907 in the ancient city of Nippur, in Iraq. His name is one among a long list of ancient kings. The cities are all in ancient Sumer, the language is Sumerian, and so the tablet is known as the Sumerian King List, the earliest piece of writing we know to list kings, kingdoms, and reigns. But that is not all that is said of Dumuzid, for he is also said to have married a goddess, to have lived in the underworld, and to have ruled for 36,000 years. And so we can only surmise that the Sumerian Kings List is not quite as clear a historical artifact as we might like when hunting for the first named leader in history. But there is no question that for at least several thousands of years, this is how humans have, for the most part, organized their communities. From small town mayors to great emperors, we have appointed a single person to be at the head of our societies, entrusting them with the power and responsibility of leadership. But the first non-mythical example of a leader we can find in written history didn't hail from Sumer. He was an Egyptian pharaoh named Nama. Indeed, he's often credited with unifying Upper and Lower Egypt in 3100 BC. But though Nama may be the first leader to have been enshrined in written history, he's by no means a rarity. We know of many kings and leaders who came thereafter, from the mythical Yellow Emperor of early China, said to have ruled for 300 years, to the less mythical but no less powerful Sargon of Akkad, who ruled arguably the first empire in history in Mesopotamia in the 3rd century BC. These leaders, much like our politicians of today, were in charge of huge swathes of land, and had to find a way to manage and control large and diverse populations. And there was also the temptation, evidenced in much of our written history, that once power was obtained, these leaders sought to keep it in their family. And yet, perhaps surprisingly, while they may have lived many thousands of years ago, pharaohs, kings of Sumer, Roman emperors, and Chinese dynasties in fact represent quite a modern form of leadership, in terms of the entirety of human history. We Homo sapiens have, after all, existed for hundreds of thousands of years. These later leaders represent only a tiny aspect of our social history, one that didn't start to appear until around 12,000 years ago. For the agricultural revolution, changed leadership forever. This period marked one of the most transformative phases in human history. Many societies transitioned from nomadic hunter-gatherer lifestyles to settled farming communities. And this fundamental shift altered social organization and the nature of leadership, leading to more structured and hierarchical forms of authority. And while we have no written records from this time, we can see evidence of the emergence of hierarchy in the structures and remains left behind by these settlers. Jericho is one of the earliest settlements we know of, established from around 10,000 BC. The site had massive stone walls and a 9-meter tower. Such structures would have required organized labor to be built, which surely necessitated oversight by someone in charge. Indeed, Jericho's scale and complexity shows how this transition from egalitarian hunter-gatherers to settled communities both required and propelled the organization and stratification of human societies, creating a feedback loop that would see single leaders rise to the top. And the development of agriculture only increased this need for hierarchy. Many were no longer relying solely on hunts and foraging, living or dying by the ability to capture prey. Humans were suddenly able to create an excess of resources through the cultivation of crops and the domestication of animals. And somebody needed to manage the creation, storage, and distribution of these resources. This meant organizing labor for activities such as planting, harvesting, and building infrastructure. And so leaders took on roles as managers, overseeing the construction and maintenance of shared resources. The development of permanent settlements also introduced issues related to land ownership, defense, and trade. Leaders increasingly had to serve as arbitrators in disputes, protectors against external threats, and negotiators in trade interactions. Here lies, perhaps, the origins of diplomacy. And this cultivation of resources also allowed for something else: the accumulation of wealth by certain individuals or families. Perhaps for the first time, we begin to see economic inequality. Those who controlled the land, tools, or surplus food would be well placed to build more power or influence.
At the Çatalhöyük archaeological site in modern Turkey,
graves from between 7500 to 5700 BC show stark differences in grave goods, suggesting disparity in wealth and status. Some bones were found with beads and polished stone tools, while others had nothing. Leadership roles may have shifted from being based on merit and expertise to being in part tied to control over resources. Again, at Çatalhöyük, we find evidence of these more entrenched class distinctions emerging. Houses at the site are generally similar in size, but some structures stand out for their elaborate interior decorations, such as intricate wall paintings and mounted animal skulls or horns. And so as settled communities grew in size, becoming towns, cities, regions, and ultimately states over many thousands of years, these very early power structures became entrenched and led to the ability to impose rules like taxes, legal systems, and armies. Indeed, these persist today. Most of us modern-day humans live in societies that have some form of law and a justice system. One of the earliest examples of such a system is the Code of Ur-Nammu, written sometime between 2100 and 2050 BC in ancient Sumer. Carved onto a stone tablet, it outlined the laws of the region, mentioning theft, assault, marriages, and property rights. And so it's clear that the Neolithic Revolution was key in driving a change in leadership into a more formalized and hierarchical structure. Leaders became central figures in managing resources, organizing labor, and providing defense, leading to the establishment of more complex social structures and the eventual rise of political systems.
And so, the social structures that govern most human societies have changed greatly over the hundreds of thousands of years our species have walked the planet. Our earliest written records confirm rulers existed. Archaeological finds show us bones and special burials that illuminate ancient community structures, and hunter-gatherer societies show us situational leadership that can help illuminate aspects of our distant past. It is clear that when we look further back into our history, to our primate cousins and our common ancestors, the dominant leader is an idea even older than ourselves.
You've been watching The Entire History of Humankind. Don't forget to like and subscribe and leave us a comment to tell us what you think. Thanks for watching. I will see you next time.